accession number 20338, Reel 2.
Terry Lyons, Reel 2.
Yeah, see, these two, he wanted to show off like the people did back here where they put a paving stone over his chest and smashed it with a sledgehammer. A similar type thing to that, really. And he loaded these people on as if the wagon, the weight of the vehicle wasn't enough. He insisted on so many of the villagers climbing board as well on the back. And his wife started giving me instructions on drawing up closely towards his chest with the front wheel. And once I was on top, I was supposed to halt for a second until she told me to come off. Well, unfortunately, the engine cut out. I mean, it was a bit of a dodgy clutch on it anyway. But the engine cut out, and I was still on top of this fella. And it wouldn't roll off. So there's a little bit of difficulty starting the vehicle, and by the time I got off him, he wasn't in a good way at all. He didn't look a happy man. He'd obviously, I'd stayed on top of him too long. His strength must have been in how long he could go to hold on to his breath. And I must have caused some damage to his chest.
How old is he?
Oh, it's hard to say, really, with them people, but I would say he was in his mid-40s.
How did you get involved in this?
This was only on a routine trip up to the line with one of the officers who decided that he wanted to stop in the village or at this camp. And obviously the CO or whoever was in charge of the camp, they'd been asked by the village for to supply a vehicle for to help this fella out. And they have no vehicles in the village, so in the camp. Yeah, there were no lorries in the village, and the CO or whoever was in charge of the camp had asked that I go and accommodate this person and act as the driver and whilst he was the stooge to show off in front of the villagers of how much pressure he could take on his chest. And then I just went back to the camp. I was just glad to get away from it all. I mean, a bit hairy, really. I mean, I didn't want to do what I did, but I couldn't have the vehicle stolen while I was on top of him. And with him forming the pillars that he had on top of him, it wasn't as though I couldn't just say to them, well, push it off, you know. And then in the end, I had to put it into gear and sort of work it that way, but then that didn't help, you know, jumping it. No, it was really not something I enjoyed doing, but that's something I can laugh about now, but most probably you can laugh about it, I don't know.
Did they show any hostility to you?
No.
What was this lorry unit you were with, this vehicle unit you were with?
It was just I couldn't really say it was an MT section. I couldn't really say it was a garage of any sort.
Was it British?
It was a school that had been taken over by the British. Now, whether or not it was just somewhere that they'd been allocated for to keep them, because they had a big schoolyard at the bottom and there were garages there. And as I say, there was from anything from Yankee Max, which is the big bullnose things that they used to use, you know, for troop carrying during the war, Second World War. And there was them, there was these 1500s, there was Bedfords, Bedford 15-tonners, Bedford 1-tonners, Bedford 5-tonners, and quite a number of vehicles. And it just seemed to be a handy point. The MO's vehicle was parked there, the chaplain's vehicle was parked there, the CO's car was parked there, and there was just one sergeant in charge of the whole lot, and he used to designate each day where you were going. and which one you were driving.
Was it the sergeant who gave you the advice about the accident?
No. The accident, yeah. Yeah. He was the one that instructed us when we got to, when we started, when we went for a test, first of all. And, I mean, the way my test went, it was absolutely abominable. I mean, I doubt if I would have passed it in Civvy Street, the test I got, because for one thing, I was driving on the left-hand side of the road and I should have been driving on the right-hand side. The other was crunching the gears because I wasn't used to the vehicle. But he seemed to think that was okay. I mean, yeah, that'll do. In other words, they were that desperate, they were willing to accept anybody. Providing you could start it and you could stop it, they seemed quite content to have you. As I say, it wasn't what I went out there for, and I became very, I got myself in a lot of trouble. I mean, that cost me something like 8 weeks' wages. They used to deduct your wages. They couldn't punish you out there then for that. I mean, I was banging in these things, and I was sort of getting myself into deliberate trouble, thinking that maybe they would then post me up back to the battalion. We were on the line as punishment. But to me, that wasn't punishment. That was being something I was asking for anyway. So that was what I was after. But they were so adamant they were so desperate for these drivers that they actually put up with a lot of nonsense from me in order to keep me there, rather than send me up to the battalion or get rid of me.
Were you allowed to give people lifts?
Well, there was no real jurisdiction over you once you were out on the road. You were your own man. I mean, it's like drivers are on the road today. I mean, once you were out there, you just did what you had to do.
You drove
from A to B. I can't even recall ever giving anybody lifts other than army personnel, or being told to drive army personnel from A to B, you know, and then make my way back.
How did you get the transfer back to the battalion then?
Well, I'd say after about 12 weeks and a lot of bother, they must have got an influx of drivers from somewhere. And eventually, I was told to pack my so-and-so bags and go to the battalion. There was a vehicle going that day up to the line with some more reinforcements from the Seoul. And I hopped on board that with my kit bag, and away I went. The rifle, and end of story, really.
What did you find when you got to the battalion?
Well, they were, by that time, they'd been pulled back off a hill. I mean, the procedure used to be, by that time, was it was all become a stalemate. And used to have what they call the reserve and the main group. Now, some of them would be up a hill to protect or to keep, if you like, get mortared and shelled each day, and others were just kept back in reserve. And then you'd go and relieve the others once they'd had a hammering, the likes of the Black Watch and Gloucesters and stuff like that. No, because they all got a hammering, and when we'd go in and take over from them. I'm not saying I'm right with the Gloucesters and the, because I think that was a bit before my time, but other regiments that had been in problems, such as the Black Watch, if they'd had a hammering and suffered really severe casualties, then they used to bring squads in out of the reserves to go and take the hill. And so as they came up, we went up. As they came down, we went up. And we took over their positions, or assisted them in digging them out. Where they'd been mortared.
Were you back with B Company?
Yes, I think I was still with B Company then, yeah. I didn't leave B Company until I got to back to Hong Kong.
What was it like in the line?
It was a bit hairy at the night time. We used to get shells and stuff like that. And there was a lot of barbed wire in front of the hills with just gaps in it where you went out on patrol into what they call no man's land. You were just guided through there by the engineer's tapes into the no man's land, and then you were either on the enemy territory. And as I say, it had all become pretty mundane stuff, other than the shelling and the flares that used to be going off and stuff like that, trying to detect you. You know, you'd have all sort of parachute flares going off, and you're told to hit the deck then. As soon as one of them went up, you hit the deck until it had gone out again and everything went dark. Then he came back and he just went on this patrol, and I recall some of the patrols saying that the patrols we made out into their territory, the enemy, which is the Chinese, they were patrolling into our territory, and some of them were leaving little gifts and stuff like that. Sort of got like a Second World War or First World War, where they all came out to Christmas, singing Christmas carols and stuff like that. And a lot of them, in fact, that Christmas they did. They put them all over the tannoys, you know, singing Merry Christmas and all that. And you used to get a lot of this other stuff coming on by, I forget her name now, they had a name for it. And she was more or less doing the Goebbels type of thing, whereby she used to say about your parents back home, and you're stuck here, you know, and you're only fighting for the Americans, and it's the Americans that we want, and it's not you. You know, you're the ones that's suffering. Many of your comrades are being killed, and all for the sake of these American imperialists, and used to give the Americans some real stick. So much so that they would purposely attack American hills or occupied them by Americans, more so than what they would ours. Many's the time the Americans have been dragged up a hill, and the hill taken over by ourselves or the American or by the Black Watch, and or any other regiments, British regiments, and then they come over on the radio, stating on the tannoy, we know that the American friends have left the 719 or whatever it was, and there's a detachment of Black Watch there, but we won't be attacking them there now, because the Americans have moved onto so-and-so hill, onto the Hook. So that's where we'll be going tonight. But it was sort of running at the Americans all the time rather than attack us. And it wasn't for the sake of being feared of us, they just hated the Americans, and more I could gather anyway. Look, that's how it come on to me.
What effect did the Chinese propaganda have?
Well, they used to keep you awake. It had the effect of keeping you awake, and it did set you thinking about what was going on back home, and so to one extent it did have the desired effect on you, whereas it would make you feel a bit melancholy or whatever it was, and would have you thinking about the things that are going on back home, your friends, and how they'd be enjoying a pint in the pub, and there's you stood on a hill listening to a Chinese woman giving you all this nonsense about what you were fighting for, and what, you know, you shouldn't be there, and Mr. Churchill, and it's going on about everybody, I think, just about everybody they were having a go at. It was the Chinese rather than the North Koreans, wasn't it?
Did you have any incidents as you went out on patrol?
No. It was only just, as I say, prior to that, there was two friends of mine, two very good friends of mine, Ronnie Montgomery and Terry North. Both of them were in the one patrol, and one night the stretcher bearer at the back, you always had the stretcher bearer at the back of the patrol, and he was complaining that he'd been carrying this thing long enough, and why couldn't somebody else have a turn, you know, and he's moaning and moaning. I mean, I'm only going now by what the reports were when they came back. But when they came back, they were carrying the two of them, and this is what it was as a result of, was him moaning. Till in the end, the sergeant that was in charge of us, or the officers in charge of us, or them, I should say, said that they were to swap over with somebody, and when they swapped over, they stepped off the markers, which they should, what's the name, and they stood on one of our own mines. One of them was very, very minutely injured, because when they carried him in, you couldn't see nothing the matter with him at all. And they finished up, they had just a piece of shrapnel stuck in the top of his mouth, right in the top end of his mouth. And he died from the shock. The other fellow was a bit worse off than him. He got a bit of a mess made of his stomach and stuff.
Did he survive?
No. Died. Both died. Both of them were dead. And of course, there'd been a lot more lost prior to that. But there was none like that. I can't recall none of them being killed. Nobody being killed while I... Once I went back to the battalion, seems things had either not been, well, they said they'd had a hard time of it, but I couldn't really see anything of the stuff that they said, or they were telling me what had happened. I mean, we weren't doing that, you know. I said, well, will we get to do that? Well, you could be called upon to do it any night now, but we never were. I don't know if it's your mind blanks all these things out, but when we pulled out from behind, from to behind the line to this base camp, and from there we went on to, what's the name, on to back to Hong Kong to finish the rest of our time off.
Did the Chinese launch any ground attack whilst you were there?
No. No, I can't recall any ground attacks of any description. They'd had them. And the ground attacks that were going on, as I say, were usually against the American occupied hills, and not anything that we were in charge of.
What were living conditions like in the line?
It was very cold. Very, very cold. You woke up at night time, and if you did manage to get to sleep, You used to get your face stuck. If you weren't careful, you pulled part of your lip away with the air that was you breathing out, you know, the condensation. That used to turn to ice, and stuff used to stick to your face. And I believe with the Americans, they often used to call it Semper Fi, good buddy. Semper Fidelis, apparently, which is something that they refer to over there.
The what?
Semper Fidelis. Keep your socks dry. Well, I mean, that's there. Still say that now on the internet when you talk to them. You know, they still refer to that, and they used to go on about. A lot of them have been going on about it, but we never had any difficulties with the stuff that we wore, and yet we were only in basics, so they seemed to be well wrapped up with these fairline parkas and stuff like that. But they said that they had a lot of trouble with the boots or something. They used to have the big lace-up boots on them. Ours were just ordinary boots, like working boots. And yet they had a lot of trouble with this, you know, with frostbite and stuff like that. We didn't seem to have as much problems with our gear, even though it was much lighter. And I don't know if George saw the same thing.
How did you get on with the Americans and other nationalities?
The Americans got on with very, very well. They were a good crowd, I've got to admit. Very hospitable. And they would go out of the way to make you welcome. So much so, I mean, they slept in between white sheets, they had the white sheets and everything, while we used to sleep in between blankets. And when we were in Seoul one night, we were in a nappy there, And these two Americans, we met up with these two Americans tours, and we met up with these two, and they took us back to their camp. By this time, we got a bit drunk, and when we woke up next morning, they'd actually put us in their beds, and we were there in between white sheets with our boots and everything on. And they were lying on the ground, shivering in between the blankets. So that's how hospitable they were. They were really, really weird. But then again, they were well looked after. I mean, they were on three times the amount of money that we were getting. They had big Yankee PXs and stuff like that, whereas we had nappies. We used to be able to buy a bar of Kit Kat or whatever it was, you know, a bar of chocolate, cup of tea, sandwich and stuff like that, a bottle of Coke, a bottle of beer. And yet then, you could buy anything from a pair of women's knickers to to a sandwich or a bottle of Coke or anything. Absolutely fantastic. It was basically a Marks and Spencer's there they had. And plenty of money to go with it.
Any contact with the Koreans themselves?
Only one or two of them based within the camp that were had positions on the camp. You know, the likes of the greasers and stuff like that, that used to grease up the wagons and change the oils and stuff like that. There was a couple of them there, and they seemed reasonable types of people.
Any events when the armistice came?
Nothing that I can recall. In what respect, any?
Wondered if any happenings occurred.
There was the transfer of prisoners. I remember being at Panmunjom when they were transferring over prisoners. Again, I'd been, by the time we were pulled back, there was the battalion had so many vehicles attached to them, and again, because I was able to drive, or had been kept behind as a driver, they sort of used me like they were the servicemen, you know, the general drivers that they had. And we went over to Panmunjom, and they were releasing prisoners there. North Koreans and some Americans were being transferred or swapped over. And also in Seoul, the same thing was going on there with the injured. They flew them in by helicopter.
What were the prisoners? What condition were the prisoners in?
Obviously the injured ones didn't look too good, but the others didn't seem too badly done by, other than the fact that they weren't dressed for the weather, the type of weather that we were having. They were just done in ordinary khaki, you know, and these baseball hat type hats that they wore, you know, like the Yanks used to wear. So,
can you tell me about leaving Korea, please?
That would be in late 52, late on in 52, towards nearly 53. We were put on board the ship called the Empire Fowey, and we were transferred from there to Hong Kong again, back to the new territories, a place called Fan Ling. And we were split up into three different camps there. The battalion was split up into three different camps, and the Norfolk regiments had vacated there, and we took it over as they came back home. Their battalions came back home here, and we took over the camps that they were in.
How do you feel now about having done your national service in Korea?
I just wish I'd seen a little bit more of what actually went on, even though I might be told you see you today. If I had been allowed to go up when I wanted to go, or if I had gone directly up there, I mean, anything could have happened. So in one sense, they may have done me a favour. That's why I'm here today, by keeping me behind as a driver. But it just sort of took the edge off what I was going out there for. By then, keeping me behind doing that job in Seoul. As I say, I didn't see the friends who I had getting killed. I wasn't with them when they got killed. And I often used to wonder whether or not things might have been different if I'd have been there. Would I have been able to do anything? And one chap in particular, Terry North, whom I met down in Seoul some 3 weeks after we got there, he came out on board another contingent to go up to the line, and we were having a drink together one night, and he burst out into tears. And I asked him what he was crying for, and he said he didn't want to go up there. So I said, I'm fighting to go up there. So I've lost 2 weeks' pay up to now. I said, I'm fighting to go up there. I said, I've insulted sergeants, I've insulted officers. I've done all sorts of trying to get up there. I said, there's hell down here. I said, you don't know where you're going from one day to the next. I said, I haven't seen an angry bloody Korean yet. So I tried to G him up in that sense. And we'd only had two or three drinks, so it wasn't the drink that was talking. And he said, I don't think I'm going to make it, Terry. So I said, don't be silly. I said, so-and-so, all the friends that he knew. I said, he's up there, you know. I said, remember so-and-so. So he said, I still don't think I'm going to make it. I've got this feeling. I said, I'm going to get killed. So I said, oh, I said, you're talking nonsense. I said, don't be stupid. But anyway, he was really sobbing. And I think 24 hours later, it may have been a little longer than that, I don't know. But I know he'd only been at the line something like 12 hours before he was called on to go out on one of these patrols, which I told you about before, where they stretch a bit. Wanted to be relieved, and he was got killed on that. And he was right mess made of him. But the other chap, said the other Terry, or Jimmy Montgomery, or Terry Montgomery, I can't remember the names now. He died with this little piece of shrapnel in his top of his mouth from the shock of it all. Oh, I don't know. he definitely had a premonition, and I've spoken to people about it since. Obviously, I keep in touch with the cadets, as they call themselves, on the American side, and a lot of them have mentioned the same thing, that people, a lot of them have the same thing. They have premonitions, or they say that they've had premonitions of where friends of theirs have actually thought that they weren't going to make it and didn't.